Thank you for joining me. I'm Julie Vecchio, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook and Instagram at Fisheries Podcast, or support the podcast on patreon.com/fisheriespodcast, along with Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robin, and John. If you're interested in showing off your support for the show or a favorite fish species, please go check out our merch over at the Fisheries Podcast fan shop hosted by Teespring, where you can find t-shirts, hats, stickers, and more. Link for the link in the show description. My guest today is Dr. Kelly Filer Robinson. She is an assistant professor at the Quantitative Fisheries Center at Michigan State University. Kelly got her bachelor's degree at the University of Virginia, her master's at the College of Charleston, where I first met her, and her PhD at the University of Georgia. During her time at the University of Georgia, she learned about structured decision-making. Her dual interest in structured decision-making and fisheries ecology led her to her position at Michigan State, where she's working with the Great Lakes Fisheries Commission, as well as other entities around the Great Lakes region, to perform research and apply the tools of decision analysis to make informed fisheries management decisions. Welcome to the podcast, Kelly. I'm really excited to get to catch up with you. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me, Julie. I'm looking forward to it.
So a lot of times I like to start off my interviews by kind of asking people about their origin story when it comes to fish and fisheries. Do you have a first memory of fishing or being on the water?
So I don't know if I have a first memory. I grew up in Chesapeake, Virginia, which is in the Virginia Beach area. So I kind of just grew up around the water. I spent a lot of time at the beach or, you know, in the estuarine systems. We did summers, you know, on the Outer Banks. So I don't think I can remember, you know, a first time being on the water, but I just remember being around the water a lot growing up.
I'm really jealous. That sounds like my ideal. So did you start getting involved in fish and fisheries in college then?
Not really as much as you might expect. So I wasn't quite sure in college what I wanted to do. You know, I feel like a lot of people, I went to college thinking I wanted to be a medical doctor, but I did quickly realize that that wasn't going to be the way that I needed to go. So I spent a lot of time just trying to understand whether I wanted to do lab research or if I wanted to do some other sort of aspect of biology. When I graduated, I still wasn't quite sure. I did get to spend some time after graduation working in a fish systematics lab at Old Dominion University back in the Virginia Beach area with Kent Carpenter. And so that's where I kind of got my first opportunity to see how research is done. And while I didn't end up, you know, in the fish systematics world, it kind of led me towards thinking more about getting into marine biology and moving into that kind of field. So, you know, I was a little bit of a slow starter, I guess, when it comes to the fisheries research.
I don't know. That's pretty similar. That's before I got into fisheries, really. You know, I spent 4 years working in outdoor education before I, you know, knew I wanted to pursue marine biology. And then when doing my master's degree, I found out about fisheries kind of by accident almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was the same way.
We're in the same master's program at the College of Charleston. Mm-hmm. And I definitely credit that program with just like teaching me that this field exists.
I 100% agree that it was a great program because we didn't have to know what we wanted to do the first year. And so, yeah, I kind of came out of the same way. I learned about marine biology and then had an opportunity to interact with so many different types of researchers, and fisheries was kind of where it seemed like the best fit. But
so your master's research project had to do with some deep water fishes, right?
Yeah, my master's project was, well, first of all, I worked directly with the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources for my master's project. So I was working on a fish that was just coming on the radar as a potential for being fished commercially. It's called the barrel fish. It's a deep water fish that was caught as bycatch of another kind of small fishery, the wreckfish fishery, and it's caught about 100 miles off the shore of South Carolina, lives in deep water. We didn't really know much of anything about this fish. So I spent, you know, my master's work looking at the age and growth and reproduction of this species. And it was a really neat first look at fisheries biology, because this is a fish that, you know, the oldest fish that we had was about 85 years old. So I had no idea that fish lived that long, even when I first started my research. We also found that, you know, it takes a lot of time to grow before it reproduces. I think it's been a while, Julie, since I've thought about the ecology of the barrelfish, but I would think it was something like 10 years before it would reproduce. But, you know, it kind of exhibits a lot of those qualities that make a fish population hard to manage, because it could be exploited, overexploited pretty quickly if we're not careful about it. I haven't really kept up with exactly what's going on with that population now, but it was just really a neat species to study, and getting to work directly with the management agency to do some of that research and learn how that what I was doing fit into the larger, you know, program for fisheries management in the state and in the country was really a neat opportunity as well.
Yeah, it really is, especially at that, you know, stage in your career, to just see the process from end to end is really fantastic. I think it's a really, really good experience to have at that point. And because they're such a deep water fish, you got to be involved during that time in some of the ocean exploration that mm-hmm. NOAA does, and using submersibles and things like that.
Yeah, so that's a really neat program that NOAA runs. It's called Ocean Exploration, and it's an opportunity for people to kind of put in applications to do research that's pretty much just explore some aspect of the ocean. So the particular cruise that I was on was put together by my major advisor at the time, George Sedbury, who since has retired from NOAA. But we were just looking at, you know, what's going on the ocean floor from on a transect from the estuary to the abyss. So if you were to still, you could still Google all of the stuff that we did during this cruise on the NOAA website, just look for estuary to the abyss. We also, you know, the whole program is put together for us to be able to do exploration, but also for K-12 teachers to be able to use that information to teach about the ocean to their students. So, you know, I got to go on a submersible. We did two submersible dives per day. I got to go down one time. I was in the back part of the Johnson Sea Link. In case you were wondering, the Johnson Sea Link is that submersible that has the giant glass bubble where you see, you know, the person driving the submersible and then a researcher. But there's also another person who works with the Johnson Sea Link and another researcher in the back. So I got to look out of a porthole, but I would certainly take that any day of the week to get to go down, you know, 3,000 feet to the ocean floor and look at the ocean life from a porthole. But yeah, the whole program was really neat. And we wrote a lot of different articles about different aspects of what we found or what we were looking at. So I would recommend, you know, if there are teachers out there that are interested in getting students excited about the ocean, look at those ocean exploration cruises, because there's lots of information and pictures and neat things to use for educational purposes as well.
I definitely used a few of them when I was teaching high school. Those resources are fantastic for teachers. They're definitely a really good building block. That is definitely on my bucket list to go and take a ride in a submersible.
I definitely know how lucky I was to be in the right place at the right time for that one. But yeah, it was pretty amazing.
One of the things that we talk about a lot, I think, through kind of various social media or other kinds of outlets in fisheries, and especially fisheries education, is deciding whether and how to go on in your education. So after, I think directly after your master's, you decided to pursue a PhD. How did you decide to do that?
Well, you know, I wasn't, again, I feel like my whole career has been, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do next, but I knew that I really enjoyed the research side of fisheries, and I wanted to be able to have my own research program, I think. You know, there was just having that opportunity to kind of ask the questions, and I knew that I would probably need to have a PhD to have that opportunity to be in charge of the kind of research that I wanted to do. So that was one of the main things, and I just wanted to continue on in my education and learn more about different types of systems. So that's kind of the basics of why I wanted to get a PhD. I kind of felt like it was the better choice for me in my career, but it was, you know, it is something where you end up being continually more specialized in something, right? So it is a big decision in some ways to continue on to get that PhD.
Yeah, I have kind of jumped in and out of the education pool repeatedly throughout my career, rather than going straight through. And I really, in some ways, admire people who could just keep chugging. And I definitely could never do that. I had to like take really extended breaks in between each one of my degrees.
Right. I did have some time between my undergrad and my master's degree, which I think was pretty crucial for continuing on in education. It's definitely a marathon. So having that break was really important for me. But I agree that, you know, it's great to continue on, but it's also great to have breaks and get a sense of what you want to do with your career, right? So if you're not quite sure that you want that PhD, it's probably better to see what's out there and get your feet wet and what kinds of things you can do with a master's degree, because it is always there, right? If you want to, you decide you want to get a PhD.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I took 9 years that I worked in between my master's and my PhD. It's always available. And I do always like to, you know, remind people of that, but you know, there definitely is.
Yeah. And I've had students too at this point who have done both. And I think that there's, you know, they could probably tell you also just like we could about the benefits and detriments of either path. So it's kind of up to the person as they're charting their career, I think.
Don't just do what everybody else is doing. Mm-hmm. Make your exactly. decision for yourself. Your PhD research moved you inland somewhat, studying estuarine fish communities. What did you like about that work?
So that was a really kind of different project. The whole goal of that was that we were working in these impounded wetlands in coastal South Carolina that were managed for waterfowl and water birds. So they actually were old rice fields that were used back in, you know, the 1800s to grow rice. And actually the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources just put together a really neat kind of arc map project about the Cumbie River, which is where I worked, that kind of tells the tale of the growth of rice culture in the low country of South Carolina and how much of that relied on slave labor. And so, you know, outside of the ecological side of this, it was really an interesting place to be, because it's where Harriet Tubman, you know, fought against some of the Confederacy to free slaves, and we're in the Underground Railroad went through there. So that was kind of, you know, culturally one of the more interesting parts of working in that system. But working in the fish part was, you know, was great, because I got to learn a whole different set of fish. I got to work with different types of people and study different types of things. I was more on the community side this time rather than studying one species. I, you know, got to learn to drive boats for the first time. And if you ask my PhD advisor, he would still laugh about my boat driving skills. But, you know, it took a lot of effort to figure out how to get these fish out of these systems in a good, nice way, or, you know, in a way that to allow us to evaluate the communities. And it was just a beautiful place to work. Lots of, as you might imagine, the bird communities were just super diverse. And the fish communities were really fun to work with. I also got to pick, you know, block nets out of alligators' teeth, because they would get tangled in our nets while we were out there working. So, but, you know, on the true research side, it was really a neat opportunity to learn about a different type of fish community and see how we might make decisions to manage these systems that would better benefit both the fish and the birds. What we ultimately found was that the fish communities in these systems weren't doing well. They would, the dissolved oxygen in the canals in these systems would get pretty low during the summer, and most of the fish would die. So we would sample in the spring, there'd be tons of fish there. And then again, you know, at the end of the summer, and the community was much less diverse, and the water had not moved in or out of these structures in the interim. So we knew that they were just not doing well in these systems. So that's where I kind of got an opportunity to think about the making management decisions too. My first, you know, kind of step into the structured decision-making process. How can we achieve our objectives for both waterfowl management and fisheries production more evenly?
That's really, really important and really cool. You know, I actually was just reading a paper that came out recently that was talking about, you know, we've kind of talked for a long time in marine fisheries management, probably primarily about ecosystem-based fisheries management and ecosystem mm-hmm. management and those kinds of terms, but everybody kind of just uses them as buzzwords rather than, you know, truly understanding what they're doing. And the argument really of the paper was that we are, even under a single species management regime, right, we are managing the fishery in an ecosystem. Like, we're considering the ecosystem every time, even mm-hmm. if it's a single species management regime, but we're not explicitly including some of those different people or entities that might need to be really actually considered to make the best possible decision within some of these. And it was interesting, you know, it was definitely a thought-provoking article that, like, yeah, this is something that we're really already doing. It's just not executed maybe as well as it could be if we were explicitly including all of the different variables.
Yeah, I actually would like to read that paper. You'll have to send it to me. But it does make sense. I mean, you know, there's the technical side of ecosystem-based management and trying to understand the math of how we can make assessments work and understand how to manage multi-species, you know, fisheries or think about this in a truly ecosystem-based framework. But there is also this need, like you said, to just make sure that we're including all of the people that actually are affected by these decisions or who could affect the outcomes of these management actions. So yeah, that's really interesting to think about in that way.
So within those impoundment systems, you said the water doesn't move at all throughout like the summer. What, mm-hmm. When does the water move in and out of those systems?
Yeah, so it's pretty ingenious the way they've got set up. So, you know, these are set up just like they were when they were growing rice, and they use the force of the tides to move water in and out of the system through these trunks that are in the series of dikes that kind of block these wetland systems from being taken over by the river itself. So in the spring, the water levels are lowered so that middle part that is, you know, formerly rice field, but is just now kind of grasses and wetland plants that are important for waterfowl to feed on is exposed. So, you know, the water is just in the canals during the summer, and at times they can burn that marsh in the middle to kind of allow for the growth of the plants that they know that the birds prefer to feed on. So then throughout the summer, it's exposed. It allows for these plants to grow. Then in the fall, they use the tidal forcing to move water back into the system so that they can flood these impounded wetlands, so that they can again, you know, allow for that plant growth that's important and allow for these birds to nest in the areas where they prefer. So, you know, I'm not a bird ecologist, so I can't tell you exactly how that affects the nesting, you know, opportunities for birds, but they really got it down to an interesting, you know, set of techniques to really provide the best habitat for these waterfowl and water birds throughout the year. Huh. So, you know, during the winter, there's lots of water in these systems and the fish, I think, do a lot better. But during the summer, it's just contained in these canals that are, you know, sometimes only maybe, I'm trying to think, I think the narrowest one we worked in was maybe like 12 feet wide or something like that, and perhaps only a few feet deep. So, it's just really not great habitat for most of the fishes. Of course, there's some fish that can live anywhere, but we have lots of killifish. You know, the gar did fine, those sorts of things. But some of those, you know, larval fishes that move into the estuary during the spring when there's some water exchange happening get into these systems and then just can't survive.
And the water in there is primarily fresh?
It depends on the system. Actually, we had three different systems we worked in. One, the farthest upstream was pretty fresh. It was, I don't know, under 5 parts per thousand, I think. Okay. The one in the middle was kind of, you know, 10 or so. And then the one, and those last two spanned, you know, Highway 17. So the one above 17 was a little less saline. And then the one just below 17, which is kind of the line of demarcation for salinity for crabbing in South Carolina, was a little more, so had a higher salinity. I want to say maybe like 20 or 25 parts per thousand. So yeah, it was pretty interesting how, you know, close together these systems were, but how much they varied in salinity.
I mean, having sampled in some of those rivers in South Carolina, it mm-hmm. was very interesting to see sort of, you know, where the salt wedges penetrated to and that kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. We spent a little bit of time sampling in the river too. We would sometimes see the South Carolina DNR folks that you probably worked with out there working as well. So yeah, it's such an interesting system to work in, and how much it changes, you know, just by the hour is pretty impressive. Yes.
Yeah, I have a lot of stories about almost getting stuck places.
Yes, for sure.
As that water's dropping out. Mm-hmm. We had to do all of our sampling on a falling tide. So it was always a race against the clock.
Yeah, for sure.
After sort of deep sea estuary and then a couple of year stint in kind of wildlife decision making, mm-hmm. you landed in a decidedly non-marine, but still very large water area. Michigan is actually my home state. And I have to say, when I lived there, I knew absolutely nothing about fisheries or most of the fish of the area, commercial, recreational fisheries, any of it. I'm sure it's actually a pretty big business, right?
Yeah, it is. So like you, I didn't really know much about the fisheries of the Great Lakes before starting my position here in Michigan. But we actually, you know, the Great Lakes Fishery Commission commissioned a study a few years ago that found that the commercial and recreational fishing industry in the Great Lakes is valued at over $7 billion per year. So it is big business. And that includes, you know, just the harvest of the fish, as well as all of the industry that supports, you know, recreational fishing and stuff like that. So it's a huge deal in the Great Lakes region. Lots of opportunities for commercial and charter and recreational and subsistence fishing throughout the system.
Mind-bogglingly huge how much, how important fisheries are, and honestly, a lot of times how little people outside of the field itself, you know, think about it or know about it at all.
Yes. And, you know, I'm sure you've had the same experience where you tell someone that you went to high school with, you know, I'm a fisheries biologist, and they say, I didn't know that was even a job that you could have. So it certainly is something that people don't always know about. And in the Great Lakes region, you know, there's a lot of value placed on the lakes. As you know, it's a huge industry outside of even the fishing industry. Tourism is a huge deal for, you know, Michigan, where we are the Great Lakes state, or what are we? We can edit that out.
Yeah, but that sounds right.
But Michigan, you know, relies a lot on the tourism and the fishing from the four Great Lakes that touch it. So it is a big industry, and people don't always know exactly what all goes into continuing to keep the ecosystem of the Great Lakes, you know, doing as well as it is.
I think that's spot on. I think, you know, it really takes a pretty huge effort to keep all of these ecosystems, you know, mm-hmm. functioning as well as they are, and hopefully, you know, continue to get to improve from low points in, you know, in the past 50 years.
Right.
So your current list of research projects is pretty long. Topics, you just touch a lot of different topics, ranging from invasive species like grass carp and sea lamprey to native sport fishes like walleye, which I've heard of, by the way, and probably even eaten, I think. Naturalized Chinook salmon and even sculpin. Which one do you think is your favorite?
No, I don't know if I have a favorite species. Maybe the sculpin, because they're kind of, you know, overlooked a little bit. But, you know, one of the great things about the kind of work that I do, this decision analysis work, is that I just get an opportunity to think about a lot of different kinds of problems all related to fisheries. So maybe my favorite thing is that I get to spend time thinking about lots of different kinds of projects. So, you know, it's never boring, that's for sure. But, you know, overall, you know, my interests really kind of lie in this idea that we've got lots of threats to the ecosystem through things like climate change and invasive species and, you know, landscape and land use change. How can we, you know, conduct research and make decisions that will help to, you know, combat the changes that we might see because of all of this ecosystem change? So You know, how can we control the invasive species that we have and prevent new ones from coming in? How can we make harvest management decisions for things like walleye that account for the fact that in a changing climate, their stock recruitment relationship may change some. We may have to think about how much risk we're willing to take on the kinds of harvest management strategies that we take. How can we stock fish, salmon into a system, recognizing that you know, there are changes occurring in the prey base, and we do have more fish that are non-native but are starting to reproduce in the system. And then with the sculpin, you know, how can we understand how invasive benthic prey fish are maybe outcompeting our native benthic fish like sculpin, and make decisions that account for that.
So it sounds like a lot of your work requires really, really large input data sets.
Yeah, right.
Is that fair to say?
At times, yeah. So, you know, my position is within the Quantitative Fisheries Center. And so a lot of what we do is work with agencies around the Great Lakes region to help them with those data sets. You know, there's lots of, like, if you're thinking about walleye, there's so much data collected in terms of, you know, commercial harvest and recreational harvest. There's folks that are doing fishery independent surveys for walleye and looking at the young of the year each year. So lots of different data sources. And then we have folks that, you know, run these through stock assessments. Stock assessment is not my main focus, but I do use the results of stock assessments in some of my decision analysis work. But it takes a lot of data to understand what's going on with the fishery and then be able to make predictions about how you might expect that fishery to behave if you were to enact certain regulations or certain, you know, quotas. So yeah, lots of data, most of it not collected by me or my colleagues at the QFC, but with the support of all of our different agency partners, we're able to make these things happen.
Yeah, it just sounds like you need just like massive numbers of different types of data sets, right? And climatological and fish and prey base and all these different things. Sounds like a very data heavy workload.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And it's also really interesting in that often you come up still against lots of uncertainty that you just don't know how to deal with or that you have to account for. You know, so if you're thinking about something like invasive grass carp, it'd be great to have lots of data, but we don't actually have that much because it's new. So how do you then make decisions in the face of that uncertainty? Or, you know, you referenced the climate data. There are climate data that can help us to think about what things might look like in the future, but there's still a lot of uncertainty about how that might play out. So even with all the data that are collected in the Great Lakes, it seems like there's always something that comes up that we don't have. So then we have to think about how we can continue to make those decisions and see how that uncertainty might actually influence what decision we might make. So it is kind of a tightrope act in some ways. You know, we've got all the data, but we have questions that require data we don't have too. So how can you blend all of that together?
There's always holes.
Yeah. Right. And you never know what those holes are going to be today, you know, 50 years from now when you actually might need those data, you know, to make decisions. So yeah, it's definitely an interesting situation.
I think you touched on this a little bit, but I wanted to hear a little bit more about the why slimy sculpin was specifically a species of interest for study. I looked them up because I didn't really know what they looked like. They're kind of a little, you said they're like a little prey fish, right? For a lot of the sport fish. So what makes them particularly important?
Slimy sculpin are one of four species of sculpin that we have in the Great Lakes. The two most abundant historically have been slimies in deep waters, and they've been, they kind of situate themselves depth-wise so that deep waters occupy a deeper habitat and slimies occupy more of a shallow water habitat. They have also historically consumed different types of food. So slimy sculpin tend to eat more of an invertebrate known as diaporaea, but what we're finding is that diaporaea have been basically extirpated from some of the parts of the Great Lakes, and we think it may have to do with the fact that zebra and quagga mussels have changed the habitat somewhat to be less desirable for diaporaea. So there's this huge kind of interaction among all these different types of invasive species and ecosystem change that's occurring that may be affecting these prey species that were historically important for things like juvenile lake trout, which is our native salmonid species. So basically, I'm interested in understanding how ecosystem change in terms of invasive species is affecting the prey fish that we have in our native ecosystem. So we think slimy sculpin in particular are pretty, we think slimy sculpin are affected by a number of different invasions. So I mentioned the loss of dicaria, which is their food source, which is causing them to potentially need to move deeper to find food in terms of another invertebrate called mysis, which has historically been consumed by deep water sculpin. In addition, round goby are an invasive species that are kind of taking over the niche of the most abundant prey species for most of our predators in the system. So they're also quite aggressive. They've been shown to outcompete other types of prey fish in systems where they've existed. They've essentially extirpated mottled sculpin from some parts of Lake Michigan, for instance. And so we think that round goby are pushing slimy sculpin deeper to get at this habitat that's more preferable. So, you know, there's a lot of things happening with this fish that we're interested in trying to understand. And so I had a master's student who looked at historic trawl data. The USGS conducts trawl surveys for prey fish every year since like the 1970s. And so what Shay found with her research is that slimy sculpin do seem to be getting squeezed out kind of between not being able to move deeper for to overlap with deep water sculpin and getting pushed out of the way from round goby. So they just have less habitat available, particularly in Lake Huron. And I have a new student who's a PhD student who's going to be conducting work in the lab and in, with artificial shelters and rivers and in the Great Lakes to understand how round goby and slimy sculpin might actually be interacting. Are round goby able to push slimy sculpin out of nesting habitat in lab situations and maybe look at them in the river where they overlap? Can, are we seeing this situation where slimy sculpin just can't compete with round goby? And on top of that, you know, you mentioned some of these salmon species earlier that I've been working on. Lake trout are, as I said, an important predator on slimy sculpin, and their populations have grown in recent years because of stocking and more natural reproduction. So we were wondering if maybe they're also just consuming more slimy sculpin and that's kind of exacerbating the situation.
So much of the time we spend thinking about the target fishes and the sport fishes and the ones mm-hmm. that people, you know, people want to eat, but they have to eat. They have to, you know, there are really important species that are, you know, an important prey base. They're really, really, and especially, you know, I've worked in systems for the last 15 or 20 years now that are incredibly diverse. You know, if one mm-hmm. species is squeezed out, there's probably something else that'll be able to use that habitat or three other things or whatever. But in a situation, you know, as you go further north, you have slightly less diversity. And so, you know, it's really important to find that what's going on in one prey species situation.
And it gets to this idea that I've been thinking about, but a lot of other researchers in the Great Lakes region have been thinking about, is how much adaptive capacity is there in the system to deal with these different types of perturbations and ecosystem change that we're experiencing with, you know, with climate change and with species invasions. Slimy sculpin is just one example of that. But yeah, you know, if the prey base is affected in certain ways, that can ripple up to the predators and affect the fish that, you know, folks are interested in catching commercially or recreationally. So how can we consider the ecosystem as a whole, and how much, what do we need to do to ensure that that adaptive capacity remains, you know, high enough that we can, the system can be resilient to these sorts of changes?
$6 billion question or something, right?
Right, exactly.
So we've talked a lot about all the different, you know, types of data inputs that you use, and that your work is pretty data heavy. Do you ever get to do any field sampling anymore?
Yeah, I get to do a little bit, not as much as, you know, maybe I might like. It is nice to get out in the field every once in a while. Yeah, most of my work does require me to be working with people or working with data. But some of the stuff that I do for structured decision making can lead to other questions for which we need to conduct research experiments. So one example is that I got to do some field work trying to compare different types of gear that are used to catch grass carp for grass carp control. So that came out of the fact that we found from our structured decision making work that, you know, you really need to know how effective the gear is that you are using to try to remove these fish,
so that you can remove enough to actually, you know, affect the population in any meaningful way. Otherwise, you're just kind of spinning your wheels in some ways. You don't, you know, you're not moving enough fish to cause the population to decline, and you're spending a lot of money and effort. So we went out, you know, sampled a few sites in Lake Erie monthly for a couple of years to see how can we do better at catching these fish. Are there particular years that work better? And I didn't get to go out every time. I had a postdoc and I had some undergrads that worked with me that went out. We collaborated with Michigan DNR and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and USGS, but I did get to go out there and, you know, net some big fish. We didn't catch many grass carp, which I guess is probably good in some ways. We aren't that many to catch, but spent a lot of time, you know, getting buffalo and common carp out of trammel nets. But it's fun to get out there and spend time doing some field work.
You're inspiring me to go out on the Great Lakes, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, this beautiful system. I mean, some of the places, so one of the interesting things about grass carp is that they like to find warm water to overwinter in. So there's places, you know, near power plants on Lake Erie where we know that we can reliably catch them at certain times of the year, but the water is, you know, kind of disgustingly warm. So it's not my favorite place to sample because it's just really weird. But beyond that, there are a lot of really beautiful places to work in the Great Lakes for sure.
Throughout your career, you've kind of lived and worked all over the eastern half of the U.S. Do you have a favorite memory from your career so far?
Oh, I don't know. It's kind of hard to beat going in a submersible, and we've already talked about that. So I think that's probably the favorite memory. Really, I think the best thing about, you know, it is exhausting to continue to move. And, you know, everyone who's been in grad school has experienced that, continuing to move to further your education and find that position where you can finally stay for a few years. But overall, I think my memory from just being able to do all of this work in fisheries throughout the eastern half of the U.S. is making lots of connections with folks, whether it's, you know, to have built friendships that I've had for, you know, 15 years now from grad school on, or to just have lots of people to be able to work with and collaborate with professionally. So it's not a specific memory, but it's been, I guess, one of the perks of having that kind of career where you end up moving a lot. I have lots of different people that I could call on about different questions about things, you know, ranging from, you know, white-tailed deer to walleye to, you know, spot or croaker in South Carolina. So, you know, lots of different people to work with and lots of fun getting to know different kinds of people and working in different types of careers.
I think having worked kind of within the same general region, but in a variety of capacities for me has been great personally, because, you know, I kind of work within the same system, but I know a lot of the different people to contact for various things. And that's super helpful.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got the agency people you can call on for certain questions, university people, but you have that background education too. And all of that is really helpful for being a well-rounded fisheries biologist for sure.
Definitely. What do you think is one dream for your works going forward? Is there a research topic you'd love to pursue if money were no object?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm doing pretty well. Maybe get to help someone with some important fisheries management issue in some beautiful tropical location, particularly if it's winter in Michigan, would be a dream.
Winter is pretty much the number one reason why we have not moved there. I think it might kill my kid at this point. He's like never worn anything but Crocs in his whole life.
Right.
Yeah. Those are like his only shoes he's ever worn. And he doesn't even wear those a lot of the time. Now the tough part of the interview is over and it's down to my final questions. We always like to start off real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
That would probably have to be the barrelfish, because it got me into doing research in the first place, and it tastes really good.
Yes. And I guess we kind of touched on this a little, but what do you think is your dream job or location?
I think my dream job is kind of what I'm doing, getting to work in all different types of research questions and work with a lot of different kinds of people. So I'd say I'm pretty happy with the kind of job that I'm doing now.
And finally, If there was one point or principle you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I think it's that you don't have to know. I've been thinking about this question because you told me beforehand that I would have to answer it. And I think it's that you don't have to know the ecosystem itself to be able to work there. So, you know, if I'm looking for a student, for instance, I don't need someone who's got an intimate knowledge of all the fish in the Great Lakes. I want someone who is excited about the research, you know, just wants to conduct fisheries research and learn. So I think there's this sense sometimes that if you don't have experience in a particular region, that you won't be competitive. And I'm certainly an example of that not being the case, because I didn't know anything about Great Lakes fish before I moved here. But, you know, so having those tools and techniques and that drive to do research, I think, is just as important or more important than a specific knowledge of an ecosystem.
Well, thanks again for agreeing to come on the show. If people want to get in touch with you, where could they find you online?
My information is certainly on the Michigan State University website. I'm on Twitter at, what is it, K. Filer Robinson? I can't remember, so I'll have to look that up for you. You can find me on the Michigan State website, and my Twitter handle is on there as well.
Thanks to everybody for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FishVecchio. The podcast is Fisheries Pod, on Facebook and Instagram at Fisheries Podcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget to head on over to our Patreon page and support the podcast if you feel inclined. I'm Julie Vecchio. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, you don't have to know the ecosystem to work there.